You are listening to rudolfsteineraudio.com. This is a reading of three lectures by Rudolf Steiner called What is Anthroposophy? Three Perspectives on Self-Knowledge. This is Lecture 1, entitled The Physical Perspective, given in Dornach on July 20th, 1923. A conviction has been surfacing recently among many of our members, especially among those with a scientific background. There is a general feeling that there should be wide-ranging discussion and debate regarding the relation between the spiritual scientific or anthroposophical view of the world and what goes nowadays by the name of scientific cosmology, the foundations of which were laid in the second half of the 19th century. Such people fondly believe that exceptionally positive consequences would follow for anthroposophy, as they see it, if anthroposophy were to begin to approach modern science, and even enter into dialogue with it. Scientific research has indeed come to play an important role in the Anthroposophical Society. Naturally, this fact is highly satisfying in many respects. But, precisely to the extent that anthroposophical scientific research has become so important, errors have arisen with regard to its relationship with science as generally understood. We should not forget that in the course of the 19th century, under the influence of what has been, and still is, generally called science, general education has taken on a character quite alien to anthroposophy. We can assume right away, therefore, that anyone whose thinking habits were formed by contemporary scientific life would find it virtually impossible to shift to anthroposophic conceptions without further ado. Moreover, we must also realize that we can hardly expect science to agree with anthroposophic cosmology in any way. Those who will find it easiest to understand the rightness of anthroposophical cosmology are in fact people whose thinking habits were not formed by today's scientific discourse, or people who, while still young, grew out of those habits as quickly as they acquired them. In these lectures, I want to look at the path of anthroposophy from three points of view that will put some life into the statements I just made. In order that friends who have traveled long distances to be here can take as much as possible home with them, I have decided to give these talks a somewhat aphoristic form. I shall trace connections among various manifestations of present cultural life, while still basing my content on purely anthroposophical statements. We know from previous lectures and books what realities we can expect to experience during the passage through death. Footnote. See, among others, Rudolf Steiner title Theosophy, title An Outline of Esoteric Science, title Life Between Death and Rebirth, title Staying Connected, and title The Inner Nature of Man and the Life Between Death and a New Birth. End of footnote. Today, to bring before your souls an idea of how anthroposophy regards the physical world, parenthesis, as it were, quote, the physical perspective of anthroposophy, close quote, close parenthesis, I will limit myself to the very first phase of life after passing through the gate of death. It is often loosely said that, given the close connection between the physical and the etheric, or formative force bodies, in earthly life, this connection continues unbroken throughout life. But, in fact, when in ordinary earthly life, ordinary human consciousness is interrupted by the states of sleeping and of dreaming, then the astral body and the capital I are separated from the physical and the etheric, formative force bodies. On the other hand, the two pairs, physical and etheric, astral and I, remain so closely united that they do not separate from each other. Therefore, in the normal course of sleep, every 24 hours a general separation occurs. The physical and etheric bodies separate from the astral and the I. However, the physical and etheric bodies do remain closely connected with each other and inseparable, and the same is true of the astral body and the eye. These two constitute, as it were, two tightly knit wholes. It is different when a person passes through the gate of death. What happens at that point is that the physical body is immediately, in quotes, cast off. A very brief connection is then established between the eye, the astral body, and the etheric body, a connection that was never present in the waking life. This connection, which lasts only a few days, produces a person's first experiences after death. What are these experiences? What is the first experience after death? It is the experience of melting away from ourselves, while at the same time seeing all that we absorbed during earthly life through our senses and the understanding coordinating them. During our lifetime, we become used to the fact that when we turn our eyes toward the world, we see colorful things. We see events and processes played out in brilliant colors before us. Our mind retains the memory of these colors, although in somewhat weakened form. We carry them in our memory as we do the impressions of the other senses. Actually, if we are honest in our self-observation, we have to admit that when, for instance, we sit quietly in our chamber and give play to our memories, that is, to our inner self, what we experience within is itself assembled from the shadowy reflections of outer impressions. In ordinary consciousness, we live either with immediate living impressions of the outer world or with shadowy memories of them. There is more to it than that, of course, as we shall learn tomorrow. Today, however, I want to focus on consciousness, the consciousness that throughout the course of life is filled with colors and colored processes that extend over all things. This consciousness is also filled with sounds and with sensations of warm and cold, in short, with all the impressions that we receive through our senses. The shadowy after-images of these impressions in our inner soul are what we call memory. Let this be our starting point. When we cross the gates of death, all that we had experienced through the senses in earthly life melts away. Within a few days, all the things that filled our soul from birth to death have dissolved into the universe. Put another way, after a brief period of unification, unlike any occurring in life, the etheric body, the body of formative forces, separates from the eye and the astral body. Let me now place before your souls a more precise description of what this experience is. To do so, I shall draw a little picture, parenthesis, Rudolf Steiner draws the physical body and around and within it the etheric body, hatched in yellow chalk, close parenthesis. In life, we can only experience what I have drawn here, this conjunction of the physical and etheric bodies, if we are inwardly conscious when we wake after sleep. We always experience this union of physical and etheric only from within, from the inside. To bring this reality before you as precisely as possible, I will now change the drawing as follows. Parenthesis, Steiner adds a green line around the yellow hatching, and around the green line, a red line. Close parenthesis. The green represents the etheric body as it reflects toward the inside. The physical body is cast off at death, so we need not pay much attention to it here. The red line indicates the part of the etheric body oriented toward the outside. As I said, we experience the etheric body in this way only from the inside and when we wake from sleep. In other words, we experience only the etheric body oriented toward the inside, the part I drew in green. We have no awareness at all of what is represented by the red line, the etheric body oriented toward the outside. We do not experience it. When we pass through the gates of death, the eye and the astral body enter into a kind of union with the etheric body. This happens as follows. Imagine that after death the whole etheric body is turned inside out like a glove, so that the inside, the part that touches the skin, is now on the outside. The part I drew in red is now turned inward, and the green section that was turned inward now is turned outward. The whole etheric body gets turned inside out. As this transformation occurs, the etheric body expands astonishingly fast. It becomes immense and spreads out immeasurably into the universe. We might represent it like this. Steiner draws a large red circular band with a green band around it. Whereas, previously, the I and the astral body were within the etheric body, now they are facing the etheric body, which is expanding into the cosmos. So that this time we are looking at things from the other side. All that had been part of us, but previously had had no meaning for us, is now turned inward. What was previously turned toward the inside, what was that mattered for us all during earthly life, is now turned outward. I'm going to read that sentence again. I believe there's a word missing. What was previously turned toward the inside, what it was that mattered for us all during earthly life, is now turned outward. It no longer concerns us. It is dispersed into the universe. All that had color, sound, and so forth in life is now contained in what is streaming outward. By means of this reversal of the etheric body, what was inside and is now outside gradually moves outward until it completely disappears from us. At this point, an altogether different world impresses itself on us. We should not imagine that we could have the very same world after death as we had before death. That world disappears. For us to imagine that we could possibly experience after death the same content as we did in our earthly lives, even as it were under a different cover, is quite false. It has no connection with the facts. What we experience as a result of the transformation of the etheric formative force body is immense by contrast with the content of earthly life. It is also something quite different. With the outside now turned inside, we experience first the whole forming of our earthly life, how it was built up. We experience this in powerful impressions that are quite different from sense impressions. We do not experience the redness of the rose, for instance, so much as we experience how the redness of the rose formed within us as a concept. Things now begin to be less peaceful than they were in physical existence. In earthly life, roses are beautiful, one beside the other in the rose garden. Each is peaceful. Each makes us feel that we are resting inside its peace. But now the rose garden becomes something quite different. The rose garden becomes events in time. On earth, in earthly life, we used to allow our gaze to glide from rose to rose. As we moved from rose to rose, we formed representations of them within our soul. First one rose, then another, and yet another. Now, they succeed each other, weaving in lightning waves, as if in the living process of becoming, not as roses, but as ideas, inner realities. These enter our inner life as if we were in a sea of events. Then something appears in front of us, something we never saw while we were on earth, the becoming of earthly life, the gradual arising of this earthly life. We now know how our soul developed from childhood on. What had gone completely unnoticed during earthly life now plays itself out before us. It is as if we had risen out of ourselves, become another second self, and were observing how, as our first self, we gradually created the simple concepts of childhood, and then the more complex concepts of adolescence, and so on. we witness from the inside the birth of this little earthling. We see how from hour to hour this earthly life, this earthly existence, is formed and developed. More than that, we have the insight that actually our whole earthly life forms out of the cosmos. Indeed, as everything that we experience on earth grows into the immeasurable, the cosmos, and as we ourselves grow outward with it, we realize that what was formed within us in our life on earth was likewise formed, built, out of the universe. Gradually, then, we start developing a valid conception of human life on earth. Let us now consider something that is considered common knowledge today in relation to human life on earth. As human beings, we eat. In this process, we bring substances from the outside world into our own organism. This is an undeniable fact. However, we also transform these substances. We start transforming them in our mouths and continue to do so as they move through our whole organism. In the process, what we take in passes over into our whole organism. Furthermore, science tells us that just as we take matter in, we are also continuously losing matter to the outside. Just think, for instance, of your nails, which you clip, and your hair, which falls off, provided you aren't completely bald yet. Starting from this shedding, you can easily observe how the human body constantly loses matter. In fact, it is well known nowadays that the human being loses matter in this way all the time, and in fact is completely rebuilt in the span of about 7 years. To put it bluntly, insofar as it is matter, everything that is sitting here on these chairs was 8 or 9 years ago dispersed all over the world. Furthermore, whatever is sitting on the chairs here would have to have been brought together no earlier than 7 or 8 years ago. And if all the muscle and blood and so forth that had been formed more than 7 or 8 years ago had not been replaced, you are all older after all, so your bodies have been regenerated several times, it would not be you sitting there. If all that stuff sitting on those chairs had remained all those years, it would not be you sitting there. Anything that you incorporated, at home or anywhere else, into your muscle mass, more than 7 or 8 years ago, your blood, other parts of your body, none of that is sitting here any longer. You have gradually expelled or shed it. But what does materialistic science tell us? It tells us more or less the following. During the past 7 years, we have all been eating. What we ate during the last 7 years is still sitting here. Whatever we ate earlier is no longer here. For instance, each one of you has a heart. Science tells us that the physical material of this heart renews itself every 7 or 8 years. For all practical purposes, every 9 years you get a new heart. This, we could say, is more or less the way present-day thinking conceives of these things. But that is not the way things are. Such ideas can arise only when people do not know what I explained to you earlier, and they fail to include it in their scientific observation and thinking. Scientists have no notion of the reversal of the etheric formative force body. They have no experience of what shows us when we pass through the gate of death, how the whole person arose. If you know these things, you are in a position to look quite differently at the human organism. Only then do you learn to recognize the truth. You might think that all the matter that went to build up your heart was gathered bit by bit from the cabbages, potatoes, and other vegetables, the cherries and plums and so on that you enjoyed eating over the years. But this is not what happened. Essentially, note, I say essentially, the heart that you carry in your body has very little to do with any matter you ate. The heart that you carry today arose, in fact, in a most mysterious way, out of the ether, that over the past 7 or 8 years you have drawn in from the cosmos. Your heart and other organs are renewed out of the ether. You did not remake yourself from the earth at all, but from the cosmos. You can see then from the workings of the etheric body after death, and how it worked through our whole life, that we are continuously renewed out of the cosmos. Here materialistic conscience, which each of us has to have, will protest, but nevertheless we all ate. We all took in external matter, as a result of which inner processes took place. Yes, but these deeper processes are not as closely related to your deeper human essence as you believe. The substances that you ate have already been disposed of in the various ways in which human beings dispose of matter. They have passed through your organism, but without uniting in any essential way with what you are. They consisted only as a stimulus. They constituted only a stimulus. We must eat for processes to take place within us that stimulate us. And in so far as they stimulate or goad us, our etheric body becomes active. The etheric body that is connected with the cosmos, not with the earth. What happens to the consumed, digested, metabolized foods are processes that create a stimulus so that a counterforce, the etheric process, can arise in you. The matter that enters into me and is physically transformed stimulates my old heart, but I myself make my new heart out of the world ether. Thus we may now set down a fact that by today's standards may perhaps seem a little grotesque. You are all sitting here, but what has renewed you over the past 7 or 8 years never lived in the potato or cabbage fields. It lives out in the universe, in the sun, moon, and stars. It came down from there. You made yourself anew out of the universe. Here I have indicated an error that inevitably arises in contemporary thinking. People only look for the connections between human regeneration and physical earthly matter. They do not look for the connections to the ether. Consequently, if one has grown accustomed to current physiological ideas, one cannot help considering anything anthroposophy has to offer as a kind of fantastic fabrication. This is why discussions are necessarily sterile. If one has mastered both current science and anthroposophy, one can see how each side casts light on the other. But one should not succumb to the hope that people thoroughly habituated to materialistic representations can be induced to switch to our side without further discussion, just like that. Such a hope can only damage anthroposophy. We must have a very clear, precise understanding of this. Only then can we see that other people first must absorb the whole way in which we integrate anthroposophy within ourselves before they can even begin to penetrate this anthroposophic path of observation and knowing. In essence, as I have said, we human beings regenerate ourselves out of the cosmos. Of course, we do not find the physical materials that we can then find in the heart, in the cosmos. This is because they are so diluted, so subtle, that they are not detectable by physical means. They are etheric. The dense matter of the heart that appears at a certain age has condensed from the universal ether. Therefore, 9 or 10 years ago, everything sitting here was still in the heavens. It was in the heavens, in the stars. In fact, whatever matter remains behind and pervades where etheric forces should by rights have been working, we find a predisposition to illness. Illness is caused by the presence within us of physical matter that is too old. Deep insights into the nature of illness are gained when we understand how matter can remain stuck instead of being expelled as it should have been. Any substance we absorb as physical matter is meant to be eliminated again. If it remains in the organism, it becomes a cause of illness. As you can see, very practical consequences ensue from the real knowledge that we gain when we have some insight into what happens to us immediately on leaving the physical body. After we die, all our sensory impressions and our intellectual interpretations of them melt away. We see the world completely differently. Minerals, plants, animals are no longer there as we previously beheld them. What we find there is the process by which we become who and what we are. We have stepped through the gate of death. We have left the stage of the earth. We have entered the cosmic stage. Another world surrounds us. It is as if we had stepped out of a tiny room of earthly existence into the majestic, powerful fabric of the cosmos. We feel we are spread all over the cosmos. No longer can we be contained, in truth, in a small earthly chamber. And on this cosmic stage we must remain until we descend once more to earthly existence, now connected with entirely new worlds, worlds whose being belongs to the higher hierarchies. Let us now extend the point of view we have gained here in relation to the human being to nature as a whole. For example, let us assume that we were to go back a very long time in earthly evolution. We would then encounter completely different life forms, completely different earthly events. As you know, there have been epochs when huge animals lived on Earth that are now extinct. Entire species and orders of species have died out. Paleontologists and geologists now search for their fossilized remains in the formations of the Earth. Let us assume, then, that we have returned, roughly speaking, to this very early stage of evolution when ichthyosaurs, plesiosaurs, and other remarkable animals were living on Earth. These beings were not the products of the physical matter of the earth. They were formed out of the cosmos, from the ether. And when the time came when these beasts gradually died out, all their etheric matter, if I may put it so, remained behind. The animals themselves were no longer there, of course. But the etheric matter from which they were formed stayed behind, just as our etheric body stays behind. And these etheric materials constituted the starting point or initiative from which later, after these etheric forms had passed through the cosmos, other beings were formed in earthly existence. And these, in turn, also left behind etheric matter from still other species, from which still other species were formed, until finally the world of animals as we know it today appeared. Take, for example, the sequence of the three evolutionary periods leading up to the appearance of the human being. You find three successive animal forms following each other closely. We know that for one form to evolve out of the preceding form, a passage through the cosmos with the help of etheric forces is necessary, just as a similar passage through the cosmos between two human lives is necessary. Thus, when we come to the third form of animals, they too pass into the ether. And then, after a certain period of time, the human being formed out of the ether appears, as always influenced by this detour through the cosmos. Now, the strict materialist sees all this and is convinced that each animal form arose out of a previous one. Clearly, they are related to each other on Earth, but an etheric activity, a cosmic activity, lies between them. In the 19th century, the practice arose of observing only the sequence of events on Earth and ignoring the consequences of cosmic activity on earthly events. The scientific view remained, therefore, first simpler forms, then less simple, and finally the human being. This is what natural science, which does not admit the etheric, gave and gives us as the evolution of organisms. It could not have been any other than it was and still is. Once one accepts its hypotheses, and the etheric is inadmissible, then the question is posed in such a way that earthly existence includes only what is visible. Then there is no choice but to accept the stream of evolution as exclusively physical. This is what Darwinians do. This is what Haeckel did. And on their assumptions, it is madness to demand more or argue about the way the science of evolution has developed. Only by adding knowledge of the etheric world can one begin to perceive what truly belongs to it. You can see, then, why it makes no sense to argue. Clearly, if a person wishes to remain within the parameters of natural science, he or she can do so. And they can always turn to those who speak on the basis of a different view and tell them they are talking nonsense. Having become used to a purely earthly point of view, they will say that what you speak of is not there. If one wants to speak differently, one must first gain knowledge of the etheric world. There is no other choice than for a valid, reasonable polemic with contemporary science than to say, in your domain, you are entirely right. Things can't be at all different, and there is no other conclusion. But if you want to speak with us about the things we have in mind, then you must first acquaint yourselves with the elementary processes in the cosmic ether. Then we can talk. Otherwise, we shall have no common ground of reality to stand on. For instance, one of our members sitting here has written a small book on botany from the point of view of spiritual science. A very negative review of this book recently appeared in a local paper. Now, what can one say? My reaction was, imagine you yourself were the botanist who wrote the review. You have never heard of anthroposophy, and the second printing of this little book comes into your hands. You would have written exactly what the reviewer wrote. It is quite natural that you would have done so. That you don't write that review and actually have written the booklet in question is predicated on the condition that you have studied anthroposophy. All one needs to do is to place oneself into the other person's point of view. Then one can write all these hostile, combative things oneself. But to expect that a person who has been working in a certain direction with all his intellectual habits, and expect that he should become different, become an anthroposophist, is a little like having a blonde daughter and deciding out of the blue that you want her to be dark-haired. That's just not the way things work. The way people have been shaped by contemporary science is not something we can simply turn around. We must be realistic about this. The second half of the 19th century gave a very specific stamp to the whole constitution of the soul. Let me give you an example from a completely different direction. As you know, there now exists something called analytical psychology or psychoanalysis. As I told you repeatedly, psychoanalysis makes some very valuable contributions, but it rests on an incomplete, dilettantish knowledge of human physiology. Therefore, it is dilettantism. It also rests on a dilettantish knowledge of the human soul, human psychology. On this basis, too, therefore, it is dilettantism. Psychoanalysis is dilettantism squared. Still, when you pursue it, even as a dilettante, it works. And one can understand that what it lacks in physiology and psychology will gradually be completed. Still, this kind of thinking does color the human soul. These days there is an immense literature on the subject. You could fill a large library with psychoanalytic literature. And of course the people who study it can get into all kinds of horrible arguments, which if you enter into the polemics are actually quite interesting. We have spoken about psychoanalysts ourselves here. As I said, you could fill a library with what's been written on the subject. And when so much has been written on a subject, this means that there is a great deal to study in that field. All this colors the human soul. Now, here is something interesting. Quote, psychoanalytic literature, close quote, already existed in Europe in 1841. It consisted in a few lines by Karl Rosenkranz. They ran, quote, "In our modern overfilled consciousness, we thrust many things back because we have no time to give them form. They remain potential tasks within us that we could work on. They are, in Tieck's words, unborn souls yearning for existence, floating as in limbo in the background of our own soul." Close quote, close large quote. In theory, all of psychoanalysis is contained in these lines. In those days, one spoke of, quote, "unborn souls living in limbo in the background of the soul, struggling to come to existence." Close quote. Today, one speaks of, quote, "hidden regions in the depths of the soul," close quote, and so forth. Then such subjects were considered so insignificant that they were worth, at best, a few lines. Today, we have become a civilization in which whole libraries are devoted to the subject. Yet everything essential is contained in those few lines. And as long as the essence of psychoanalysis remained encompassed in those lines, the libraries were filled with all kinds of other things than they are today, and people wishing to learn took up other subjects. A psychology student embarking on a dissertation nowadays would have no choice but to tackle psychoanalysis. One just has to study it. And this colors the whole soul. In 1841, the essence of the subject was expressed in those few lines. It was just not considered important. It was not seen as something of great significance for human thinking. And the same is true of many other things. It is of tremendous significance what particular range of facts we concentrate on, or don't. In 1841, human beings slept through psychoanalysis. It only surfaced in one person, Karl Rosenkranz, in the form of one isolated thought, which I just read for you. He dreamt about it one day. Dreams are fleeting things. They do not influence one's life much. People in those days filled their waking life with other things. Nowadays, on the other hand, people sleep through many other things because they want to keep awake for psychoanalysis and related subjects. If we want anthroposophy to become relevant to the world, we must take a closer look at this phenomenon in order to decide where to apply our energies. It certainly is not enough simply to engage in polemics. Polemics are like a person fast asleep in a room, snoring away, while another person, who is awake, goes to great lengths to try and get the snorer to understand what is being said. But the sleeper is not to be awakened and snores on. Therefore he or she cannot possibly understand what is being said. And it is just as difficult for people to understand each other if they are each asleep to the other's realm and are only awake to their own. Many people are asleep to anthroposophy. They will not easily wake up to what anthroposophists have to tell them. But one wishes for anthroposophists themselves to awaken to the others. Then they would not approach others on the basis of blind faith, but out of genuine insight into the value of the other, and understand anthroposophy's inclusive quality. They need to understand why it is that anthroposophy includes what others consider the one and only thing. They need to understand that anthroposophy must widen its horizons by reaching out to areas which others see only from their own narrow perspective. I have given you here one perspective, the one that is revealed when we look more closely at the nature of what surrounds us on this earth and which melts away when we die. This is the physical perspective. In order to understand it, we had to allow it to lead us to its immediate neighbor, the etheric. We will consider next the perspective of the soul, how the human being awakens to the perspective of the soul. Then we shall conclude with an examination of the spiritual perspective of anthroposophy. These then will be our three perspectives. The end of Lecture 1.